So, Charlie, talk a little bit about the what Anthrax is currently doing for my first question. What do you guys have going on right now?
Currently, we just wrapped up a tour, this Killthrax tour. It was us and Killswitch Engage. We did the second part of it because it was a success, and we really enjoyed it, and the other bands enjoyed it, and we decided to do it again. So that just finished. Now we're taking some time off before this run with Slayer happens starting in May.
Now, obviously, you're playing a show with Slayer and doing a tour with Slayer. And, you know, for you, coming out of the same school that they did, I mean, basically coming up to that whole thrash metal scene and playing shows with those guys and being, you know, in the Big Four, you know, recognized with Slayer. And obviously, they're going to be retiring. You know, what kind of legacy do you feel that they leave on the metal scene and the music scene in general?
Well, I think the group of bands that started in, let's say, the kind of early 80s really opened up a whole different mindset to a form of music that was going for quite a while, you know. The end of the 70s really started to spawn a style of music that would become heavy metal, you know. And then in the early 80s, you had the British bands that were doing it in such a different way from the bands from the 70s that those are the bands that we started to look up to, like, you know, Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, Motorhead, and then it's a kind of natural progression that the next batch of bands would kind of be derived from the sound that was created by those bands. So, you know, us, Metallica, Slayer, yeah, you could hear Iron Maiden, Motorhead, Judas Priest influence in all those bands. So then what we did was we took it from England and kind of Americanized it. And then that sound spawned bands that would come into the late 80s, into the 90s, you know? And it's funny how far it's come now, but it's also rewarding when you hear a new band come out and they kind of sound like you guys, you know what I mean? It's, wow, that's, it's pretty amazing. So I think the legacy really lives on in the youth that comes with that next generation, you know?
Now, let's talk a little bit about how you evolved, because, you know, the bands in the Big Four all had their own sound. I mean, you know, you had Slayer had that raw aggression going on, and then, you know, Megadeth had kind of the more complicated song structures, and, you know, Metallica had a certain heaviness and everything about them. But Anthrax, of course, was a much different type of band, and, you know, your drumming style was just so fast and a lot crazier than I think a lot of these other bands. And, you know, then over the years you have, you know, settled that down a little bit, and your playing has improved quite a bit, and I think your drum lines and everything, you know, have become a lot better. And maybe, and let's talk a bit, you know, about how you have evolved as a drummer.
I mean, back then I was more or less thinking of, I wasn't thinking about how I was going to phrase this section. I was just thinking about, boom, it was just spontaneous and just kind of basically coming off of the riff that I was hearing in my head. And just how, you know, mentally and physically, you know, how I was going to marry it with the drum beat or the drum performance, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it became that. By the time our third album started to roll around, that's when I really started to think about, you know, parts and phrasing and how am I going to approach this? And always took a page from the Neil Peart, you know, book of, okay, well, here I go. I said this on the last record. What am I going to say on this record? You know, that type of thing. And try and take it to another level. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work, but for the most part, you know, I feel like I achieved what I wanted to achieve.
You know, I was following you on Instagram, Charlie, and I was watching you play a pretty killer riff on there. And is that a prelude, say, to the, you know, next Anthrax album?
Yeah. I was just pretty happy with the riff, and I was just like, I couldn't contain myself, so I posted it.
Now, I know you come up with a lot of the basic song structures for Anthrax, and you know, when you're doing a lot of these guitar parts, you play a lot of guitar, do you find yourself thinking about, hey, this is how the drums gonna go when I, you know, when this song happens? Or, you know, is that something that comes later on after you come up with some of the initial guitar riffs for, you know, say a song you're gonna put on the next record?
Sometimes it's right then and there. It's almost as I'm playing it, whatever's in my head is something that I'm already mixing it in my head. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, okay, so I think the drum beat should be this. You know, quite a few times it's happened where I had, you know, when I go into, like, when we meet, like, I'll go into, like, a room with Scott to start, you know, showing him, you know, here's what I have and blah, blah, blah. And then the way he hears the riff is completely different the way I heard it in my head. He would say, oh, I didn't hear the drum beat like that. I heard it more like this. So then I'll try it like that, and it's like, oh, yeah, that's cool too.
Now, I'll get into another subject here with something that you've been doing, you know, kind of off of the record as far as music goes, but you know, you're selling coffee and you're a big coffee enthusiast, and talk about how you are starting that and getting into that.
I mean, I've always been into coffee since I was a real, you know, real younger, and coming from like an Italian home, coffee was always something that was flowing, and it's always been a part of it, you know. And then about, man, I want to say about a little over 10 years ago, Dave Mustaine and myself started this coffee thing. Dave actually started it, and then he asked me if I wanted to be involved, and I said absolutely. So we started doing coffee, and then he kind of backed out of it. He just didn't want to do it anymore. But then I continued it, and I did it completely independently through a roaster in New Jersey, and it was something that I just fell in love with, and I just wanted to do it. I wanted people to taste the coffee that I had in my head, and you know, in the taste that I wanted. So I did it. And then a company here from Chicago called Dark Matter Coffee, we got involved with each other, and yeah, let's do it together. So they since started doing the coffee for me, and it's been great.
You know, and let's talk a little bit about, you know, the band's career as of right now, because, you know, it seemed like when Worship Music happened and when the Big Four thing happened, that everything in this band and everything in Anthrax from then on seemed to just have this great positive vibe to it. It seems like the music has been very good. I think the last two records have been great. And on top of that, it seems like all the band members are just fitting so well together yet again. And you know, it's a different thing going on for Anthrax, because I really think there's this huge positive vibe that I detect just by listening to the records and also watching you guys play live. And why do you think that has happened? And, you know, talk a bit about the state of the band the way it is now, because I think there's been a positive vibe for like the last, you know, 8 or 9 years.
I think it really comes down to one thing that we, some of us in the band had pretty much I would say, spawned off into different things, and maybe the interest wasn't there as it was in the past. And I mean, I remember at one point shitting on a couple of songs for worship music, and kind of like I was kind of minding the store on my own. I mean, Scott was doing some other things. We really had no singer at that point. And it was kind of in a bit of disarray. And then something happened where Metallica were going to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and they invited Scott and myself to the whole thing. And after the whole award show, Metallica had a party, and Scott and I were at the bar there with Lars, and we were just talking, and Lars brought up the fact that they've been thinking about doing like a string of Big Four shows, and what would we think about that? And we were like, wow, that would be amazing. You know, that would really be cool for the audience that loves metal and the audience that loves these bands. I thought it was a great thing. And we continued talking for a bit, and then Lars left to go talk to someone else. And then Scott and I looked at each other, and we were like, we got to get our shit together. And I think at that moment, that was it. We were on a mission, and we had to regroup and really get that mindset again of this is important, this should be important, and let's all get on the same page here and do it. And from that moment on, really, momentum started to build, and it's never stopped.
Now, to do the whole Big Four thing, you know, obviously you guys talked about it beforehand, but to actually go out on stage and play the first show, what was it like for you to step on stage and actually play those shows and, you know, step on stage for the first time with all of these other three bands playing with you, and describe what it felt like?
Well, the night before the first show, Metallica set up a dinner for just the bands. No managers, no, you know, Wranglers, no anybody. It was just the four bands. And it's funny because when everybody went to sit down, the bass players sat with the bass players, the drummers kind of sat with the drummers. And then after the initial hi and everything, then everybody started to mix it up a bit. And by the end of the night, it was all laughs and, you know, haven't seen you in a while type of stories. And it was really good. And I was really happy that that happened, because it, I think, put everyone at ease for the next day. It was kind of like a great moment that, you know, everybody went to sleep with a great vibe. And it just reflected in the next day, and then the day after that, and it, you know, so it was a really good thing to do, and I was really happy about it, just about everything that transpired from that night.
Now, you know, the music business, as you know, and you've been around a long time, you know that it's a very tough business to be in, and, you know, to be doing this for as long as you have been, what has kept you going through this whole thing? What has kept you going as a musician and as a band in a business that's very, very tough to do anything in?
Well, I think what happened with the music business was the ground kind of fell out from beneath all of us, and everybody kind of scrambled to think of ways of compensating for what had just happened or what has been taking place. Mm-hmm. And I think some bands who thought they were maybe smarter than other bands started to do things where we'll give the music for free and you tell us what you want to pay for it. And I thought that was really stupid to do, because maybe they thought that was a great thing at the time, but I felt it was just devaluing music. And mm-hmm. what we were doing. I mean, why would you, you know, do that? Does that mean that, you know, all these chefs from around the world are saying, just come to my restaurant. If you like the food, just pay what you want, or don't even pay at all. Don't worry about it. I'll survive. And I just thought that was a real ignorant thing to do. And if we go deeper into this conversation of why this happened, you really have to put a lot of blame on the tech industry. You know, as much as everybody loves Apple, I also think Apple had a big hand in destroying music. And nobody really says that. Everybody's still on the side of Apple, but I believe Apple was one of the big hands in this that helped destroy music. Mm-hmm. The record companies had a big hand in it because they got greedy. The artists got greedy when they felt, oh, I could get a 3-album deal for $75 million. But at the end of the day, if they're taking all that money, what happens to the lesser-known bands who are striving to become something? What happens? Where does that money come from? I mean, it was just such a mess. Mm-hmm. And it really dug a hole for itself. And now who's paying for it? Everybody.
You know, I've been doing this radio show for such a long time, as we talked before, and, you know, it seems like the record companies really have not found any kind of successful business model to adapt to the more modern times either.
No, they're not going to either because of streaming sites are very successful. And it just goes to show me, especially, I'm an audiophile, and I have to have the best quality of a song from my favorite band. Mm-hmm. But to a lot of people, that doesn't matter to them. It really doesn't. They'll listen to music on these little earbuds that really shrinks everything, and that's it, man. It's like, oh, it's my workout tape.
Yeah.
How it is. So the love of music, and I was just talking to someone about this yesterday. The reason why the title of our album is called Worship Music was because I worship music. I need it in my life. I need it every day.
Right.
And what happens when the time comes when there's not enough money and people have to have a GoFundMe thing to make some music, then what happens?
Well, there's bands pretty much already doing that right now.
Yeah, I know they did, and it's like, that's sad, but that also has, it's like the breakdown of the family when you don't have a dad or you don't have structure anymore. That's exactly what's happened to music. Mm-hmm. And now you have to go and independently try and raise some money in order to live, because it's all been broken down. The days of artist relations, artist development, all that stuff that was so important to, let's say a band had 3 records on a label that didn't really do so well, but then that 4th record, bam, exploded. And then those 3 records prior to it also start moving. You'll never have that happen again.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny, a good example, let's say Metallica. You know, it's a good example of that. When Injustice for All came out, that was a very big record for them. And it did so well that their previous 3 albums probably started to sell because of that, and so on and so on. And now these labels, they don't know what to do anymore.
Nobody knows what to do anymore. Everybody, like I said, is just the next scavengers. They'll pick up whatever. Well, maybe this will work. Well, I'll try that. And that's why a lot of bands on tour are doing these meet and greet packages, because they have to find some way to fund the tour. Mm-hmm. Understand? Because records are not selling anymore. So the experience has become what is become profitable for the bands to exist, which I have a hard time with that, because I still, there's a piece of me that just feels like, man, making people pay for coming to see you is weird. But now you really have no choice in to do that.
You know, playing drums in a band like yours, for example, you know, it's very physical. I mean, there's a lot of physical activity that has to happen. And, you know, the older you get, you know, obviously doing something that physical could take its toll on you. But, you know, you seem to be in great shape. You seem to play just as well as you did, you know, say 20, 30 years ago. And what has kept you in great shape and being able to do that still after all this time?
I still play, you know what I mean? I still get inspired by things that make me want to sit behind the kit and do this. It's a very primal thing. I think drumming is, it's just a primal thing that's inside of you. For me, it's been a very early age. Like, I was born and boom, I was a drummer. It wasn't something that I had to learn how to do. I just knew how to do it. And it's the same thing with guitar playing. It's a very instinctive type of thing where, I mean, yeah, I had to teach myself how to do it. But once you get the basics, boom, man, you can take it to anywhere you want to take it. So I still get that. There's been some nights where, of course, I feel like I'm going through the motions a bit. But then there's nights when I'm just so motivated and just so in a zone that I sometimes forget where I am and I'm just playing. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, it seems that record companies, and someone in another interview that I did mentioned that record companies just can't do, they can't move large groups of people like they used to be able to do, say, 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, I think a lot of times with the record companies, for myself, I would go up to, when we were on island, if I was down the city, I would go up to Island and just hang with people in the office, because I always felt that these are the people that are working for you. It's always important to go up there and say hi, so it's not just a picture that's in front of them that they're working on. It's a human being, and I always felt there was a need to have a relationship with them because, like I said, you want them to feel good about what they're doing every day. And it's like, oh, you know what? These guys, I really like them. So, you know what? I'm going to stay here until 8 o'clock tonight and just make sure that this gets done. Just shit like that. And it's, you know, I thought it was important. And believe me, I loved the record companies back in the day. I learned so much from that, especially the art departments and stuff. I would spend so much time with them. And, yeah, it's a thing of the past.
So, with vinyl reemerging and all that stuff, are you a big fan of that?
I've been a fan. You know, it's something I caught on a long, long time ago. And, I mean, at the end of the day, like I said, I'm an audiophile, so vinyl is great. But it's not the best way of listening to something. You know, there's a lot of pops and scratches and hiss, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Still, the best way is still that form of pure, you know, digital type of, sound. But I love vinyl. Don't get me wrong. I love it.
You know, I remember being a big fan of Stomp 442, and I was also a big fan of stuff like Volume 8, I thought was a good record, but it was a very dark time for metal. And during this time period, because it was such a very big, dark time for heavy metal, there, you know, I started meeting these European bands when I started doing my show, and, you know, nobody knew who they were. But then, you know, it started happening about the 2000s where heavy metal started making, you know, a comeback again, because, you know, a lot of these European bands, you know, were big in their own countries, but they really weren't that big here. And, you know, and everybody started to see a resurgence and everybody benefited from it. I know you guys, you know, have been doing well for quite a number of years. And why do you think metal, why do you think it came back and, you know, out of the dark ages, and talk a bit about how the resurgence basically happened?
The thing that happened, see, over in Europe, a lot of times, metal has always been a way of life. And this is no disrespect to metal fans here, because they do exist here, but fads in America seem to catch on a lot more easily than they do over there. And there's always going to be metal there. I don't care what anybody says. They never will abandon their metal. Over here, when we released those two records that you mentioned, metal was such a dirty word to say because you had this alternative stuff that came in, which basically just dressed like hard rock, heavy metal in a different way. But the thing that was changing was the hair metal band that was just kind of permeated and, for what I feel, kind of hurt real metal. That was being... there was a tsunami that came in and washed that completely away. Problem is, the thing that came up from that was a lot of the alternative and grunge things that people mistook for some new saviors that were going to save music. But all those bands were basically heavy metal rock bands that were the same exact thing. You know what I mean? Just dressed it down a bit. Over in Europe, I think that style and everything didn't really change over there. So all those things that were going on there, those festivals, were still very metal-driven, and it never changed. So basically what started to happen in the 2000s is that whole shifting of the guards, alternative and all that crap, I was kind of... It was realized that, whoa, this was kind of all fake stuff. And then the music started to kind of come back. And a new generation was coming up that were listening to their dad's or their older brother's records and starting to rediscover things like, you know, Megadeth, Slayer, Anthrax, Metallica. And then you had American bands coming up like Lamb of God and Killswitch and Shadows Fall that were taking where we left off, you know what I mean? And it was a resurgence, and that pretty much brought us to where we are today.
You know, but even though metal was seen as a very dirty word, at the same time, Charlie, you know, it seemed that like a band like Pantera did so well during a very dark time. And, you know, Dimebag Darrell was also a guy that really... you know, he could really play guitar solos, which was something that really wasn't really looked down finally by record companies. But somehow Pantera was able to survive through the 90s and carried a torch. And, you know, what was it about them that you feel that they were still able to do well when heavy metal was still supposed to be uncool?
Oh, I think Pantera got in that door that was closed and really, really took metal to a different level, no pun intended. And I think it was important that you had a guitar player like Dimebag at the time. That guitar playing was looked upon as, you know, like Kurt Cobain was considered the top guitar player at the time, if you remember back in those days. And it's like, I think Kurt Cobain would be the first one to say, man, I'm a musician, songwriter. I'm playing the guitar in a song. I'm not flashy or anything, you know? And you had someone like Dimebag who grew up on Eddie Van Halen, who was taking guitar playing to another place in the 90s. And I just think that they captured something. And it was new and it was fresh. And yeah, they definitely had their audience.
You know, when I first saw this happening and saw metal coming back, it, you know, I was working for the band Helloween, who of course you've done gigs with, you know, in the past and did a tour with at one point. And, you know, what was interesting is that they sold like 50 copies of one of their albums here at the time. But when they came and played a show here in the U.S. about 20 years ago, for it was the first time they had played here in 10 years, there were tons of people. There were tons of people out there that want to see them, and this venue was just so small you couldn't fit everybody in there. And, you know, it seems that there were still a lot of metal fans around here, but at the same time, it almost felt like, you know, even though the record sales weren't there, the fans were still here.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, there's so many times where I feel like, wow, hard rock metal is doing really well again. And then here in Chicago, for instance, 2 weeks ago, the big rock station, The Loop, got bought out by a Christian radio station. And it's like, oh, well, that's definitely going to hurt. You know, And people are like, nah, dude, you know, you got Sirius and you got this and you got that. And I'm like, yeah, dude, but people who drive in their cars to work and home from work, they listen to, you know, terrestrial radio. And it's like, this is important, you know?
You know, growing up as a kid, you know, and even now, you know, Anthrax has always been one of those bands that, hey, if I want to put myself in a pretty good mood, I'm going to put an Anthrax album in. Because, you know, you guys as people have always had this positive vibe to yourselves, you know, in comparison to some of the other bands. And it reflects a lot in your music. You weren't writing about killing, you know, killing people and blood and guts and stuff. You're just writing about fun topics and real life stuff. And, you know, I've always had such a positive vibe for you guys. And is that something that you, that's intentionally put into your music, or is it just, you know, is it just natural for you to write like that? Because to me, that's how it comes off, and how your music comes off as well.
It depends, you know. There's some songs that are, that can be taken like that as in a positive way, then there's some that can be taken the opposite. You know, I find most times when you're writing about real life stuff or relationships or, you know, certain emotions, that I think everybody can kind of draw their own conclusion about an experience that they had from it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. One of my favorite lyricists has been Neil Peart forever. I just love the way he tells a story and the way he describes things. In a very, you know, artistic and intellectual way. He's one of those guys that just enjoys coming up with a bit of a story to tell, you know, and I love that.
Now, you've played some shows in Cleveland over the years, obviously, and what is one of the best memories you have of playing shows in Cleveland? What are some of the things that you have that you remember, or maybe name one thing you remember about playing here in Cleveland?
I remember one time we played this place. It was on the Anthrax White Zombie tour, and such an awesome show. It was like one of our best shows in Cleveland. And afterwards, Al Jorgensen was there, and he wanted to travel with us for a couple of shows, and we were like, absolutely, sure, why not? And it was one of those times when everything was happening, you know, and like with the weirdness of even Al being at the show and just kind of wanting to hang and come with us was one of those moments that you only read about in like a magazine, and things were starting to happen. It was, you know, that was one of my favorites in Cleveland, you know.
Well, for my last question for you, Charlie, obviously, as I ask everybody this, and I don't think I was asking this question when I interviewed you before, but, you know, any last words to say to the fans and that are going to be checking this interview out, and any of your fans out there that are going to be listening to this?
I would just say, not to sound like in a cliche type of way, just I would have to say thank you for just being, you know, a fan of not just our band, but all the bands that you guys support and love. And I know it does something to you when you hear music, because it does something to me. And whenever I get a chance to meet someone who I respect and love, I just have to tell them, you know, and, you know, I know you must hear this a lot, but, you know, thanks for taking the time to create something that really inspired me and inspired others. And I think that's what the important thing is how it affects you or what it does to you. Mm-hmm. And that's what music should do. Same with the book, same with the movie, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Man, it should can make everything inside of you feel like it's moving, you know?
Well, I can tell you, I get that, because I remember talking to you, as I mentioned before, when I was a 19-year-old kid. And, you know, once I spoke to you and getting to speak to somebody that impacted me like you have and Anthrax has, then, you know, that's a basis of, and that's probably a big reason why I've continued to do this show for 20 years.
That's awesome.